supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. It's Election Day, and in Pennsylvania, the ballot includes a slew of judicial candidates and a proposal that could pave the way to overhaul property taxes. Philadelphians are electing a new district attorney. South Philadelphia resident Jamie Fontaine wants the office to step up its scrutiny of law enforcement, a major theme of Democrat Larry Krasner's campaign.
The police need to be held accountable for the way that they treat people, especially people of color. And I think that's an incredibly important issue for the district attorney to be aware of.
Philadelphia is a majority Democratic city, though some believe that Republican candidate Beth Grossman can still win the DA race. Rita O'Connell from the city's Tacony section cast her vote while hearkening back to a previous district attorney.
Let's give a woman a try again. Linda Abrahams did a great job. So let's try a woman again. Let's see how it works out.
In New Jersey, the entire state, Senate, and General Assembly are up for re-election. Meanwhile, outgoing Governor Chris Christie's low approval ratings have led to strong opinions on what his successor should or should not be like. And many voters are dissatisfied with the two major party candidates. Longtime Democrats and Republicans report ticket splitting with their gubernatorial choice. Many remain undecided up until the last minute. As part of Voting Block, our collaborative reporting series on the New Jersey governor's race, WHYY's Joe Hernandez introduces us to a South Jersey voter struggling with this year's choices.
Krista Cooper has just stepped outside after voting at the Paulsboro Firehouse wearing a black jacket and a white head wrap. Cooper's been thinking about the governor's race for months, but hasn't really liked what she's heard from Democrat Phil Murphy or Republican Kim Guadagno.
I was kind of undecided up until this morning, really undecided as to how I was going to vote.
When she got into the booth on Tuesday, she voted for all the down ballot candidates she already knew she supported. Then she got to governor.
That was the last vote that I made. I went through all of the different issues that were on the ballot and everything. So governor was the last one.
Cooper is a 45-year-old mother and grandmother, born and raised in Paulsboro, a blue-collar town of 6,000 people just across the river from the Philly airport. I first met her at a community meeting in April. Near tears, she told the mayor and police chief that more young people were loitering on the street outside her house, littering their cigarette butts, and she thought selling drugs. Cooper said nobody was doing anything about it, and she was worried it might end in tragedy.
I'm afraid the next time it's going to be one of our babies. I appreciate the...
Hi, how are you?
Krista.
Afterward, I met her at her house, and we talked about how small-town Paulsboro had changed.
There is a large number of young people out on the corners and standing around and doing a little bit of everything that they shouldn't be doing, and zero accountability.
Cooper works at the local Boys and Girls Club and spends her off hours shuttling her kids back and forth to their sports games. She says recently, out-of-towners have been renting apartments in Paulsboro and bringing, quote, animosity to its streets, giving the town a rougher edge. In October, she watched the first gubernatorial debate between Guadagno and Murphy. The moderators asked questions about property taxes and pensions and immigration, but Cooper didn't hear a lot about some of her top issues, like housing and crime.
Right now, I don't see an answer in these two candidates. I see a continuation of the same situation.
Cooper went into that debate thinking she'd vote for Murphy. She's a Democrat. But Murphy struck her as a typical politician who just didn't understand her. Cooper was so disappointed, she switched to being undecided.
It changed me from being, okay, I'm Democrat and I'm going with the Democrat. It changed that.
That's 16. So before this debate, you would have voted for Murphy.
I would have went that way because that's just the way that we go.
Cooper hasn't always paid attention to politics. She watched this race closely, partly because of President Trump's election and partly because she's starting to think about retirement. Even then, she found it difficult to sort through all the noise, like the campaign mailers and TV ads.
You really have to step aside from all of that stuff and do a little more research and find out what it is that they're saying. Because when they get into the debates and that mudslinging, you don't get to hear the real ground that they're running on.
When she finally got to have her say on Tuesday, Cooper didn't make her choice based on any particular candidate's policy or personality. It was on the word of somebody she trusted.
Just on what my former president said. And that's what I believe in. So that's what I went with.
Former President Barack Obama endorsed Phil Murphy in the race. Obama even showed up to campaign for him. And it was that endorsement that guided Cooper's vote.
And that Barack Obama said that he was the person to go with to help New Jersey move forward. And so, like I said, I'm trusting my former president and what he said. And that was a big turning point for me as well.
Phil Murphy is the favorite to win, according to the latest polls. But whoever takes the top job in Trenton next year, they can be assured that Krista Cooper will be following along closely. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Many activists are celebrating Mayor Jim Kenney's decision to relocate Philadelphia's controversial statue of Frank Rizzo. For Solomon Jones, the moment is bittersweet.
I thought I'd be happier when I learned that the Kenney administration had decided to remove the statue of former mayor and police commissioner Frank Rizzo from the steps of the Municipal Services Building. After all, I'd spent more than a year voicing my discomfort with Rizzo's legacy being celebrated on public property. Rizzo's statue, which I've long viewed as a memorial to police brutality, should never have greeted visitors to our city, especially when the nation is locked in a debate about the killings of unarmed black men at the hands of police. But now that the decision has been made to move it, I'm at once relieved that the Kenney administration made the right choice and grieved that removing a symbol of brutality does not change the substance of this moment. The systemic abuse that Rizzo oversaw was such that the Justice Department filed a 1979 lawsuit saying the Philadelphia Police Department's unfettered use of brutality shocks the conscience. But even Rizzo, who directed his police to attack children protesting for black history lessons and oversaw the stripping of Black Panthers in the street, might not be the worst offender in today's environment. That's because police brutality no longer seems to shock anyone. Rather, police brutality seems to be the norm, especially in black and brown communities. From Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, to Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Ohio, the list of names is both familiar and lengthy, and the numbers point to disturbing racial patterns. Black people, regardless of gender, are 2.5 times more likely than their white counterparts to be shot and killed by police. And while black men make up only 6% of the population, we comprise 40% of unarmed people who are shot and killed by police. And a ProPublica analysis on fatal police shootings found that young black men are 21 times more likely to be shot and killed by police than their white counterparts. That is today's reality. And while I join progressive activists in celebrating the administration's decision to remove the Rizzo statue from public property, I'm painfully aware of the fact that my people are still dying unjustly at the hands of law enforcement. I'm grieved by the fact that our cries for relief have been met with a demand that we give unwavering support to the same police who are killing us. But more than that, I'm determined to move beyond this first step in the long, hard march toward justice. Thank you, Mayor Kenney, for choosing to move a symbol of police brutality. I now invite both the mayor and the police to join us in moving the needle. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog on WHYY.org and can also be heard weekdays from 10 to noon on Praise 107.9 FM. A British reggae musician is at Drexel University this week, transforming an archive of forgotten funk and R&B recordings into dub music. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the Philly sound is being molded into something Jamaican.
Back in the 1970s, a recording studio in Philadelphia called Sigma Sound was legendary for shaping the Philly sound, that lushly arranged funk and R&B music the city was famous for. When the studio closed in 2003, many of the tapes were donated to Drexel University, which discovered a trove of multi-track tapes, some of which had never been mixed or released. Now, the London-based musician Biddy McLean is poring through those old tapes from 40 years ago to find reggae gold.
The influence of soul music on Jamaican music is vast. I mean, there isn't a singer from the vintage era that wouldn't identify a Lou Rawls or a Marvin Gaye or Nat King Cole.
Plenty of reggae musicians took influence from American R&B and the Philly sound, but it's rare to be able to work directly with these old soul recordings, like this song called I Need Your Love So Bad by a fairly obscure singer named Billy Bass. What makes these tapes at Drexel's archive so special is they are multi-track, so you can do things like pull out the vocals, listen to the horn arrangement solo, or just the rhythm section.
When you push up a drum track and it's one track of drums, and it was just six tracks, the whole song was six tracks, drums, bass, guitar, horns, strings, and then piano and guitar on one track, and that was the song. Six tracks, and you could hear all the spillage. So on the drums there was piano, and on the piano there was drums, but that's the chemistry of these recordings. Soul. It's like in music, you have great musicians who have feel. You can't teach feel. You can teach someone how to hold sticks and say, one, two, three, one, two. But feel is something you can't teach. I've worked with so many musicians over the years, and it's not in the instrument, it's the person behind the instrument.
Biddy McLean got his start in music by working behind the board in sessions with the band UB40. And he had a handful of reggae hits on his own, including covers of Dedicated to the One I Love and Fats Domino's It Keeps Raining. He's in London, and he got hooked up with Drexel through the label Reservoir Records, which bought the licensing rights to the Philly Groove Records catalog, which includes recording sessions that were never released. The label invited McLean to go to the Drexel archive to write new songs from the old recordings. This is the rhythm track for a song called I Don't Want to Make You Wait.
I didn't mean to break your heart.
McLean wrote his own lyrics to go on top.
Seems our love had died from times we've been apart.
I love writing love songs. That's just naturally me. I love to sing about love. Not to say that I write love songs means that it's baby, I love you. There's so many different complexities within writing a love song. You know, it could be about breaking up, it could be caught cheating, begging for one more chance.
McLean asked Drexel to send him these rhythm tracks with no additional information. He wanted no lyrics, no names of the artists, no string melodies, no guitar lines. He wanted nothing to influence how he might write or sing the new song. After he finished the song, he was shocked to learn he had been copying tracks from the Delphonics, the Philly R&B band from the 60s and 70s that had huge hits like La La Means I Love You and Ready or Not, Here I Come.
Hardest project I've been involved in to date. Because the expectations, I mean, the Delphonics, oh my goodness, I get cold sweat. Cold sweats? I'm setting myself up now as a target.
I'm always doing you wrong.
To be in a comfort zone is the worst thing as an artist. To just be cruising through your career. So I'm not in my comfort zone. I'm in my comfort zone in terms of the music I love. Soul music, reggae, jazz, rhythm and blues. So I'm in that comfort zone. It's something that I love. But in terms of songwriting, every song is a challenge.
After 2 weeks working in the studio with Drexel students, Biddy McLean will return home to London to finish the job. He expects to have 12 songs ready for release next year. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Monument Lab, a citywide public art project produced by Mural Arts Philadelphia, asks the question, what is the appropriate monument for Philadelphia today? In Kensington, Detroit-based artist Tyree Guyton has created an installation designed to raise questions about time and reality. WHYY's Annette John Hall explains.
How do you value time? At an abandoned warehouse on the corner of A and Indiana, with paintings of dozens of clocks installed on all sides of the five-story building, the piece is the brainchild of Tyree Guyton.
He was one of the original social practice artists. He was doing this work before anybody else was.
Executive Director Jane Golden knew Guyton would be perfect for the Philadelphia Project.
The notion that process is as important as the final product and that what happens afterwards has equal value is something that he values.
He's famous for the creation of the Heidelberg Project, an evolving outdoor art installation of paintings and found objects that transformed Guyton's blighted Detroit neighborhood into a community that drew international attention. Over several months in Philadelphia, Guyton worked at the site with residents who live next door at Impact Services, a nonprofit that provides housing and support services to veterans. Through painting the clocks, resident Mike Nelson unlocked artistic talent he never thought he had.
It was an experience. It was different. It was freeing.
Something else happened, too. People started taking a stake in the project, and by extension, their community.
When I say I've seen the culture change, I really have seen it shift.
Project manager Gabby Raska said since work began on the installation, drug activity on the block has lessened.
They've moved down. They moved over into the park. The dealers, instead of taking up all four corners of the intersection, they kind of squeeze over to one, the one farthest away from the building.
Raska says that's what community art has the power to do. Monument Lab, with installations created by more than 20 artists at 12 sites around Philadelphia, continues through November 19th. Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
The Nat King Cole Show was the first network television variety show to be hosted by an African American, though it failed to attract advertisers and was canceled after 13 months. Lights Out, Nat King Cole, which runs through December 3rd at People's Light, follows the American icon as he faces his final broadcast. Theater blogger Howard Shapiro sat down with Coleman Domingo, the playwright.
Coleman Domingo, thank you for being with us. You are a busy guy. This month, you have two openings in one night.
There's a lot happening. I'm now celebrating my 25th year in the theater, actually. This is my 25th anniversary year.
And congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I realize that I'm still doing all the things that I was doing when I started theater in San Francisco, which was I was always working on many platforms. I was always just trying to tell stories, whether I was acting, directing, or writing.
You went to San Francisco right after you graduated from Temple?
Yeah, exactly. Right after I went to Temple and I studied journalism. I took one acting class at Temple University and then another one at the Walnut Street Theater School in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
And then, so it was still in the back of my mind, but I didn't know how you can make a life as an actor and artist. And I moved to San Francisco and I decided to give it a shot.
Was there anything you could transfer from your journalism training?
I think all of it, I think. I think as a journalism major, I wanted to go into newsprint and then I wanted to go into photojournalism. You want to document why we're here. In my plays that I write or the things that I'm drawn to as a director or as an actor, it's really about just trying to reflect who we are. And so I feel like everything is still related to the initial impulse of being a journalist.
The idea to do a show about Nat King Cole actually began here at People's Light, didn't it? Maybe, what, 2 years ago?
Initially, it was about 2.5, 3 years ago, and Zach had this idea. He said, you know...
You're talking about Zach Berkman.
Yeah, oh yeah, Zach Berkman. Zach just told me one day, he said, you know, I've always wanted a piece developed about Nat King Cole. And we just talked about it. Then I settled in on his variety show and the loss of that and this man who handled it with such grace. And then I thought, there must be something underneath all that grace. You can't possibly just live in the world that way. What's underneath this man? And so I wanted to look at it through the lens of someone in 2017 who was also an artist and the things that artists must endure. It's also indicative of myself and my co-writer, and also director Patricia McGregor, the things that we deal with as artists on a daily basis and are artists of color. We're two artists that have a large platform. So the question is raised, what do you do with the platform now that you have it? And so we have to harken back to someone like Nat King Cole.
Nat King Cole was a groundbreaker, of course. He was the first African-American man on television to have his own variety series. But he had a big problem. Mm-hmm. He couldn't get advertising. Isn't that correct?
Yes, he couldn't get national sponsors, and that was part of the demise of the show. Because of the pull of the South, you know, advertisers were afraid that people in the South would boycott. It's a money-making machine. Do I think that we're far away from that? No. The thing that I bump up against as a playwright is that it seems as if there could only be one African-American point of view per season in some way. Mm. So you're bumping up against your comrades like Robert O'Hara or Terrell McCraney or Brandon Jacob Jenkins. It's almost as if, you know, black folks are a monolith, but you can only have one experience per season instead of a few different perspectives because we're just humans. Anytime your work is out there, everyone's always thinking, well, will this make money? Will people be drawn to it? And we don't want to put distance between ourselves and some other possibilities.
You've got an estimable performer as Nat King Cole, and among a large cast, it's Dulé Hill.
Yes. With Dulé Hill, it makes it so easy, actually, and with Daniel J. Watts, two incredible performers. They keep investigating the role and the steps and the relationship. So it's stunning to me. We have the most incredible cast. It's a dream cast here.
Coleman Domingo, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so very much. It's so lovely speaking with you.
Coleman Domingo spoke with Howard Shapiro. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. When the polls close at 8 in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, stay with WHYY throughout the evening for election results and analysis. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.